like the slow motion sleepwalking through the same old train wreck, but never mind. We perhaps dodged the bullet like the POWs who survived Hiroshima by jumping into the cesspool, but they were begging to be killed. Me first, Señor Trump. Soy mexicano y estoy en México aquí mismo en Bahía Ishi. Ya hilan libre. Mm-hmm.
Sentence me to 20 years of boredom for trying to change the system from within. I'm coming to reward them. First we take Manhattan, and then we take
So, con la revolución del disco, you know, voy a leer este. After sitting on Wiener's child abuse case for weeks without warrant requests, FBI Arab Sting murder boss gets $500,000 from Clinton Foundation, who gets, like, by the dozens of millions from the Saab, never mind, ISIS funders, to ignore We Arm ISIS emails. That's the Podesta emails. Found on Anthony Weiner's laptop, Humedin's, no, he's the one sexting the 15-year-old. According to VoltaireNet, quote, British Minister for Defense Michael Fallon has announced that his country is going to reform the Free Syrian Army. This means that his government is going to take over the training program for the so-called moderate, quote-unquote, combatants, which was launched by President Obama in 2014. Free Syrian Army was created by France in 2011 and headed by the Libyan chief of al-Qaeda, Abdelhakim Belhaj. Oh, yes. Hillary for Libyan ambassador. Let's hashtag that campaign. Belhaj, yeah, we know that. Oh, he sued for being tortured in Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo or wherever. The operation was presented as an aid to the Syrian deserters led by Colonel Riyad al-Assad. Progressively, the members of the FSA joined al-Qaeda, unquote. That was from VoltaireNet. And according to U.S. law, conspiracy to murder internationally protected persons, Title 18, Section 1116, 1117, quote, whoever kills or attempts to kill a foreign official, official guest, or internationally protected person shall be punished as provided. That's 1117. Quote, if two or more persons conspires to violate a foreign official, that's 1116. 1117 says, if two or more persons conspires to violate section 1111, 1114, 1116, which I just read, or 1119 of this title, and one or more of such persons do any overt act to affect the object of the conspiracy, each shall be punished by imprisonment for any term of years or for life. If the victim of an offense under subsection A is an internationally protected person outside the United States may exercise jurisdiction over the offense if an offender is afterwards found in the United States. So, all Hillary's murders get to be prosecuted under the law. So, that's from the U.S. Code. Anyway, in 04, Jim Crow coup traitor Kerry, that first part is a noun. 04, Jim Crow coup traitor Kerry didn't lift a finger when I reached him by phone in the horrible 80s during Getty versus Casey, as Ninth Circuit was refusing to docket my request for a pre-briefing conference on which of the government's contradictory positions applied. State Department denial or Department of Justice defense of CIA for assassination manual as he was driving getaway vehicle in Guns for Drugs, quote, investigation, unquote, of the endless Contra war. Now, Kerry hopes to revive Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. This is from the Japan Times. I'm not going to read it, but you get the drift. That's what they were all running from. Because, of course, it's bad news for usted y yo, probablemente. Never mind. Oh, yeah. Okay, thank you, Leonard Cohen, for scribbling this.
I'm guided by a signal in the heavens. I'm guided by the birthmark on my skin. Guided by the beauty of our weapons.
Okay, now I gotta say, DJ Mouse, founding member of Bolshevik Anonymous, realizes that only by appealing to a power higher than ourselves can we overcome our disability and be happy hippies, and happy hippies don't kill people. So.
First to take Manhattan.
I remember when we took Seattle, remember 1999, we took calls from Michael Deal handed off his talk to Joe on the streets of Seattle. And anyway, first we took Seattle, you know, shut down the World Trade Organization. And then before we could repeat the process in the home ground of the banksters, the World Trade Center, there was going to be a WTO organization. But that was upstaged by the CIA, false flag, domestic terrorism, made in USA. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'd really like to live beside you, baby.
Now, this is the theme to
I love your body, your spirit,
Falcon and Snowman, where he's telling his girlfriend goodbye.
But you see that line that's moving through the station. I told you, I was one of those. I don't like your fashion business, mister.
To rejoice, she left in a body bag. Hillary Clinton. Max Kaiser here with the Kaiser Report, standing in front of the Jacob Javits Center in the lower west side of Manhattan, home of the most spectacular political flameout of American history. She came to rejoice, she left in a body bag. Hillary Clinton, probably never to be heard from again. What was supposed to be a celebration turned into a funeral. Oh my God, what a catastrophe. Stacey.
Max. The voters came they saw what Hillary Clinton stood for, and she died a political death, a quite gruesome one, almost as gruesome as the one she inflicted upon Gaddafi of Libya. Now, how did that death happen, is everybody asking. How did this death happen for Hillary Clinton?
Well, okay, so the polls up until the evening were saying that she had 85% chance to win, and then an hour later it went 90% for Trump. So in those whatever half a dozen swing states, they flipped, and presumably dodging all the investigations that have been so much, you know, all of a sudden we got to start over with, okay, let's find the links to Trump, because of course, if you're going to leave your cell phone in a taxi, if John Podesta is going to have secret, you know, these assassination campaign programs running under his own name, and his password is literally password, this is like Special Olympics for the anti-war movement, but...
And it's quite fitting, as we said, that it happened at the Jacob Javits Center, so...
But remember, we are like the... POWs who escaped Hiroshima nuking by jumping into the cesspool. That's who Trump is. This is a cesspool, okay?
I thought from the beginning, and we've covered it here in Kai's report, that the fact that she had said, we came, we saw, he died about Gaddafi, and then cackled, that should have disqualified her from the very beginning. But right now, as we speak in America, there's a lot of finger pointing and there's little self-reflection from the Beltway media. They're pointing the fingers at everybody else but themselves.
Oh, exactly. I mean, those moments in Libya were horrifying. And Hillary Clinton seemed to think that they were amusing in some way. I think that scared a lot of people. Like, they don't want this person in the White House in the Oval Office to have their finger on the atomic weaponry because, quite frankly, she seems deranged and unhinged. So we won't be seeing that anytime soon. Now
what the fuck is this guy talking about? Okay, Wienergate blackmail ability required. Now, you don't think Trump is on that Jeffrey Epstein... jet with Bill Clinton and all?
Hi everyone, I'm Spiro with NewsBud.com, joined with Sabelle Edmonds for NewsBud Spotlight. We're going to be taking a look at some of the information that's been coming out throughout the presidential campaign. WikiLeaks has been posting a whole lot of information, leaking out in emails. Specifically, more recently, on John Podesta, the chairman of the Clinton campaign, or the former Clinton campaign. And we have been receiving a lot of emails asking us what's our take on John Podesta's email content that has been leaked. Sabelle?
Well, let me first start by saying thank God the elections shenanigan is over after 1 year plus of nothing but puff information and billions of dollars, to be exact, over $6 billion of expenditure, having this mockery called presidential elections in the United States. So I'm glad that that part is over and behind us. Hopefully we won't have much more after that. So hopefully people will go back and start paying attention to the real news, to the real stuff that is happening around the world. I have been receiving tons of emails, inquiries from people talking about these recent emails that points out to some pedophilic operations and network and Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton's involvement with that. But to be exact, the main questions I have been receiving from people has to do with, well, Sabelle, you exposed Dennis Hastert as a pedophile in 2006. You have spoken about how Congress gets to be blackmailed based on the documentation that the FBI and other agencies have on them, documenting, recording their sexual deviations and other skeletons they have in their closets. How come you haven't been talking about it? Well, I answered that. I have been talking about it, and I have talked about it. I have talked about it. It was published on Vanity Fair magazine in 2006 through Boiling Frog's post, through James Corbett's Report, We have talked about not only Dennis Hastert, but we have talked about Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky in Illinois and her pedophilic husband, Robert Creamer, Bob Creamer. Even that name, Bob Creamer, surfaced during all these email leaks. The fact that he visited, and this is a convicted criminal. He's a crook. He's a charlatan. He was engaged in money laundering, etc. This is the guy who's married to Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky. And Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky is the woman that I talked about under oath during my testimony, and about the fact that her activities, sexual deviation activities, she was having lesbian love affairs with foreign spies, and they were using those and blackmailing her. And meanwhile, the U.S. government was collecting all this information, but instead of bringing it into some prosecution or exposing it, they were using it against her. Same thing with Dennis Hastert. Same thing with dozens of other congressional people. So the main question people ask is, well, Sibel, do you think this points out to some sort of satanic, pedophilic cult operation for the government? And I want to clarify what is happening here in the most simple way. Look, I have talked about the fact that one of my FBI whistleblowers, and this was a decorated agent, okay, who never became a public whistleblower, but he went through court cases with the FBI internally because he went to the DOJ IG, that's Inspector General's office, etc. One of the things that this guy exposed, and I went to the media, and I had this guy on the record with him, but they never published, was he was working between 1993 and 1997 in this division in the FBI, where one of his tasks was running background check on federal judge candidates. And this is during the Clinton administration. Because those federal judges have to be cleared by the FBI. They look at their backgrounds. Are they pedophiles? Are they rapists? You know, do they have some financial nefarious activities, etc.? And he said during these 4 years, when this FBI agent, this decorated FBI agent, and this was 10 years or 7-8 years before he blew the whistle, he was running background checks on these federal judges. The way they were selecting the ones to appoint were the ones who had the highest number of skeletons. Meaning the government, this is the Clinton administration, this is the FBI, this is the head of DOJ, they did not want to appoint any federal judges to the bench and go through the confirmation process if the judges or the candidates didn't have enough skeletons. Meaning they have to be rapists, pedophiles, despicable characters. And that information is collected during the background check. And then they are used against these judges. So the judges rule per government's instruction. Very simple. Same thing. One of my main whistleblowing facts that I exposed, and this was in 2002, between 2002 and 2006, And if people were to go and visit my state secrets gallery, they're going to see all these individuals, whether they were from the executive branch or congressional people, they were involved in the case I was exposing.
Oh, how wonderful. Now, I had mentioned Trader Carey of the vote fraud in Ohio, second Jim Crow coup. I was talking to him as part of Getty versus Casey. So when we have the situation and the system involves eight centuries of standing around King John with the hands on the hilts of our sword, he signs agreeing not to punish without a dozen, and it appears in agreement. So the implications only work themselves out after, 1775, the common law gets to recognize the criminality of slavery, and then of course for a century this house of bondage carries it forward. But nevertheless, the laws that were involved are being when Yahilan Libre recuerdos. Soy mexicano. Estoy en México. Y cuando los saldo los genocidas invadores quien mataron Yahi y cuantos otros. Los alcaldes son respeto por los militares. The military kept in place the judges so that that law was being, you know, the abolition of slavery occurred here almost two centuries ago. So that the same judges in common law, okay, how does common law view the genocidal invasion and, you know, the criminal invasion and the genocide represented here in Yahi Line Libre in Mexico? Porque esto es Mexico unless you are on the side of the criminal invasion and genocide. Okay, if you call that a crime, entonces reconozco en México hemos abolido esclavitud hace casi dos siglos. Here in Mexico, we abolished slavery almost two centuries ago. So common law recognizes the law that is continuous here in Ishi Bay, Bahia de Ishi, Yahi Line Libre. The la ley, yo reconozco, this hippie vegetarian, you know, it rings like a bell when thou shalt take the life of no living thing. It comes from who alone gives and takes. You know, do not disrespect love. Do not trade your soul for riches. Do not bear false witness of this law to use against another. And similarly, just like, you know, esteemed children of light recognize certain things, you don't have to write them down, you know, because, you know, the soldier can't kill you. You get to lie to the soldier, you know, or the thief at the door. You get to lie, okay? You just can't use it maliciously. Okay, never mind. And you can't know that I wasn't lying just to pretend to be, because I'm the quintuple agent, really. Never mind.
And I talked about the fact that they were all blackmailed. Blackmailed by whom? They were blackmailed by the deep state. So instead of saying they formed a cult, I have to say what they do is the deep state, they want to make sure that only blackmailable, maybe I made up a word here, blackmailable candidates get to hold offices, whether executive offices or they are in Congress, you know, whether they are in courts, federal judges. If you're clean, if you're squeaky clean, and if you start running for a major seat position, the chances are you're not going to get there because you will be disqualified. They don't want you there. They cannot put pressure on you via blackmail. So that's the answer to the questions. No, we're not gonna join this crowd and talk about there is a cult. It's not about cult. This is how this corrupt system has been operating. I exposed this. We had Russell Tice, one of my whistleblower members. He was with the NSA for 15, 20 years. He came and he talked about the fact how NSA was collecting dirt, not only on judges and senators and candidates for Congress, but even on the presidential candidates, straightforward. They were collecting dirt. Why do you think they are collecting dirt? Obviously, these people are not going to jail. Nobody's putting them into trial, and that was a major portion of my whistleblowing case, and that's why, no, I'm not going to rehash the whole thing. You are really interested in that? Everything is documented. You can listen to some of the podcasts. All you have to do is Google Sabelle Edmonds, Pastored, Pedophiles. You can put there Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, okay? Jan Schakowsky was selling information to Israel. Jan Schakowsky was being blackmailed by certain foreign agents here in the United States. Jan Schakowsky's videotapes, sex videotapes, and her husband's pedophilic activities, they were contained in thick, large files in the FBI's Washington, D.C. office in coordination with the FBI's Chicago field office. So I am tired of rehashing this. I have done it long before there was a guy called WikiLeaks. We put forward whistleblowers long before they were other pseudo alternative media who are making like a big cake batter with this. Go do your research. You see that we have been on the record. What can we add to this? What we can add to this is you have this illusion of some democratic government. You feel like you have some power. You feel like your vote means any shit, but it doesn't, okay? This is a corrupt system. What you're looking at is dog and pony shows, is filled with illusions. And the people that you obey, the people who are passing laws that you obey, you operate under, they are criminals. They are selected because they are criminals. That's how it goes when you say chicken or the egg. In this case, it's a pretty obvious thing. So instead, let's start looking inwardly and say, we the people abide by the rules and the laws passed by the criminal class.
And the Journal of Muslim Minority Affairs, which listed Abedin, the wife of disgraced Democratic politician Anthony Weiner, as an editorial staff member, published articles that pushed the narrative that the U.S. deserved the 9/11 terrorist attacks. The magazine also opposed human rights of women, unquote. That's from, conservativebase.com, Trump proven, right? Well, I mean, a pig can say something. It doesn't mean that it's wrong. Okay. Where do we go? Huma Abedin, a radical Islamist linked to Muslim Brotherhood. Well, yeah. And child rape is a part and parcel of the Arab Spring, so... What else is new?
And that, what does that say about us? Now, I want you to go and chew on this and think about this. And that basically takes care of that question, Spiro.
Well, I think you covered that as well as that could be covered. I mean, that's all there is to say about that. Of course, the criminal elite only are going to pick and choose compromised individuals to fill the positions. And they're no more than puppet positions at that point. So, and as you said, you've been on record for over a decade exposing all of this.
Yeah, here's the thing though, Spiro. We don't do the things to be popular. See, if we wanted to be popular, a popular news channel, we would be like these monkeys, these idiot monkeys, for 48 hours, for 48 weeks, for whatever, 69 days in a row, nothing but the Hillary Clinton and Trump and Hillary Clinton. As if really in the end it's going to make any difference whatsoever. Every single one of these channels, whether mainstream or pseudo-alternative ones, what they did was they were perpetuating a criminal system.
Yeah, but nevertheless, since child rape is integral to the West Arab Spring Salafist Principality assassination project, it will take our deaf, blind, and dumbest investigators to survive the pretense. Quote, killed in a small plane crash over Aurora, Illinois, Gary Caradori was a retired state police investigator who had been hired by the Nebraska Senate to investigate what the Washington Times called a homosexual prostitution ring on the morning of 6/29, the Times reported, a homosexual prostitution ring is under investigation by federal and district authorities and includes among its clients key officials of the Reagan and Bush administration, military officers, congressional aides, and U.S. and foreign businessmen with close ties to Washington political elite. Gary Caradori died mysteriously while investigating Lawrence E. King Jr., not CNN cable news network, Gary King. A very influential black Republican and close friend of George Herbert Walker Bush, King was director of the Franklin Community Credit Union in Omaha, Nebraska, and was suspected of embezzling $40 million. Within weeks, the Nebraska Senate found itself questioning child prostitutes who accused King of running a child prostitution ring. One of these children said that she saw George Herbert Walker Bush at one of King's parties. Now, of course, we have this local one, the latest fracas that has cost a bunch of OPD. And let me grab the Bay View because there's a little article on that. back to blackmailability, and it's in iTunes. Yes.
The red pill, blue pill. Look at Newsbud. We stayed clear of all that because we are not into this popular game. We wouldn't be establishing this media organization. There are hundreds of those. There are thousands of those. It is just the surplus, enormous surplus of entertainment news. And, oh, people want to hear. If you put the hashtag in our news and put the Clinton or Trump, then we're going to get attention. Well, screw that. We don't do that. We are not in that kind of a game. We don't play games. And our audience are very selective. We are looking at quality reporting. We are looking at facts. We are looking at macro causes, the root causes of the disease, the diseases that have inflicted all of us as a nation and has consequences for the rest of the world. We are not in the business of popularity. You want popularity? Get out of here. Go find somewhere else. We are not into what is the popular topic. Let's cover that. That's not us. And with that, let's talk about our Kickstarter here campaign. This Saturday is going to be only 2 weeks left out of business. Let's put it that way. It's going to defeat the open source notion, meaning, no, there is nothing in this world that is free. All those free news you're getting, they're coming at a very, very big cost. You know, either it's the big advertisements for the corporate media.
Don't forget about the Revolutionary Free Lunch every afternoon, People's Park. Well, it says 3, but it's probably more like 3:30, although it might all be gone by 3:30, so you might have to stand in line, so whatever. But what do you mean there's no such thing as free? There's food, not bombs, okay? Okay, got out of the way, and let her finish, because then it'll go on to something else I chose back when I was...
Corporations, mega corporations.
Alvin, if you're silent, I will read the open cop story, because...
Come over to the window, my little darling. I'd like to try to read your palm. I used to think I was some kind of gypsy boy before I let you take me home. Now so long, Marianne, it's time we began. Well, you know that I love to live with you, but you make me forget so very much. I forget to pray for the angels, and then the angels forget to pray for us.
Well, Ben, let me just send this out into space on a little expanding sphere of radio frequency, not the peculiar, FM is frequency modulation, so it will juggle up and down around 104.1 million cycles per second. Now, a million cycles per second, or no, it's like 1 point. Okay, so it's closer to, we're close to like a meter, anyway, our little quarter of the sine wave. So, anyway, when you take the transmitter, you'll learn all that stuff, the transmitter course. Because, of course, the moon is like a second away, 300,000 kilometers, and speed of light is about that much in a second. So, anyway, back to the Oakland cop. Angels, listen up. Because who do you turn to when the cops are trying to kill you? I don't know. But maybe you might. So, one more time. Where is feeling? And it says, first Oakland cop arraigned in underage sex scandal, wouldn't you know, is Bunton, the one we already know, has been tipping off the hookers when the raid happens on International Boulevard. Now, these involve, like, 12, 13, 14 year olds that are, the scandal here. On Friday, September 23rd, 2016, the first Oakland police officer in our crisis of corruption went to court. Brian J. Bunton, B-U-N-T-O-N, who allegedly abused his power as an officer of the law, was arraigned on several charges, including felony obstruction of justice and misdemeanor engaging in an act of prostitution. Now, of course, there is the act of coercion, using your money to force someone to do something they wouldn't otherwise have. You know, sounds like rape to me, but they call it marriage here, but never mind. And then there's this. Okay, if you're dealing with an underage child, it is rape, period. Señor Puerco. As we finally move forward in the continuing saga of abuse of power by police officials, the question, jumping to page 11, looms. Does obstruction of justice really matter? Is obstruction of justice a victim of crime? Well, let me wipe the puke off the page here. What is obstruction of justice? Obstruction may consist of any attempt to hinder the discovery, apprehension, conviction, or punishment of anyone who has committed a crime. The acts by which justice is obstructed may include bribery, murder, intimidation, and the use of physical force against witnesses, law enforcement officers, or court officials. For anyone who is tempted to think that obstruction of justice is a victimless crime, I offer the story of prosecutorial misconduct in Bakersfield, California. There, Kern County Deputy District Attorney Robert Murray admits to falsifying a confession transcript that he provided to a defense attorney. Murray gave it to the defense attorney during plea negotiations, when Murray knew defense counsel was trying to persuade the defendant to take a deal. Yes, yes, yes. All the way to the top. Maybe. An arrest is made now. As coined by Frederick A. Hicks to Pope, or it was the, oh, that maybe I missed a, oh, closer to home. Closer to home, in July 2010, the Oakland City Council approved a $6.5 million settlement in a case which exposed the routine use of this paper is hard to read. Never mind. I need to find glasses and try again.
So long, Marianne. It's time that we began to laugh and cry and cry and laugh about it all again. We met when we were all in the green lilac park. You held on to me like I was a crucifix. As we went kneeling through the dark. Oh, so long, Marianne. I'm weeping. Cry and laugh about it all again. letters, they all say that you're beside me now. Then why do I feel alone? I'm standing on a ledge, and your fine spider web is fastening my ankle to a stone. Now so long, Marianne, it's time that we began to laugh and cry and cry and laugh about it all. For now I need your hidden love. I'm cold as a new razor blade. You left when I told you I was curious. I never said that I was brave. Oh, so long, Marianne. It's time that we began to laugh and cry and cry and laugh about it all. Oh, you are really such a pretty one. I see you've gone and changed your name again. And just when I climb this whole mountainside to wash my eyelids in the rain, oh, so long, Marianne, time that we began.
And this is the sixth edition of the Russian Newspapers Monitor. Dear friends, our Kickstarter campaign is still going on. Please, comes from the Rossiyskaya Gazeta, the Russian government-owned newspaper. Let's begin with the edition for November 8, 2016. Of course, the focus is on the US elections. This edition was published on the day of voting, and so the final outcome was still unknown. As I pointed out in one of the previous editions of the Russian Newspapers Monitor, most Russians preferred the victory of Donald Trump. They thought that his victory would lead to the improvement in the US-Russia relations. Now, when we know that he got elected, we will follow closely to see what happens. The article in question deals with economics. It is an opinion piece by Yakov Mirkin, a well-known Russian economist, and it examines how the US elections will influence the Russian economy. The title of the article is "The Dollar Loves the Democrats." Mirkin begins by explaining that the United States holds one-third of the world's financial wealth and 24.5% of the global GDP.
Well, let me go back to this. I mean, got all the pages lined up. Closer to the end. The tip of the iceberg. Officer Brian Bunton facing felony charges for obstruction of justice and prostitution appears to be the tip of the iceberg in Oakland. In our case, it appears that many people... appears that many people went to great lengths to conceal ongoing widespread criminal activity. We know that OPD investigations received a suicide note from Officer Brendan O'Brien in September 2015. We know that OPD investigators looked into Jasmine's cell phone with all its incriminating text messages and recorded calls. We also know that access and information to Jasmine's Facebook page was publicly available. Public police chiefs in both Richmond and Oakland were allegedly her Facebook friends, and yet every one of the local district attorneys staunchly maintains that she or he did not even know about the suicide note or the OPD investigation until she or he, Oakland cop, continue from page 11, read about it in the East Bay Express newspaper. Oh, maybe I should go there. Well, this is SFA. Clancy are clearly higher officials than Brian Bunton. We are all victims of the obstruction of justice because we have to live with the fallout. Public safety requires public trust. Who can we believe? The mayors, the DAs, the chiefs? I'm not sure that any of them has any credibility left. Where were they for 9 months? Who else should be charged with obstruction of justice? What do you think? Feel free to post your comments on pamelaspage.com or at my Facebook page. For more information, contact attorney Pamela Price, 510-877-0024 or PYP@PYPESQ.com. She asks readers to sign the petition for an independent investigation, donate to the Jasmine Freedom Trust Fund, which is established and administered under the nonprofit Bracelet Charitable Freedom Fund. All donations are tax deductible. Well, I skipped some of that, But back to Russia views Mosul.
When the United States economy is growing, the rest of the world follows on the growth path. When the United States economy is declining, this trend is also reflected globally. Mirkin notes that it is on the Wall Street and in London City that the prices are decided for the main Russian exports, oil, natural gas, precious and other metals, and so on. In other words, the fate of Russia depends on what goes on there. He states that the last six-year growth of the U.S. economy, officially from 1.6 to 2.6% a year, together with the growth of the Chinese economy, 7 to 10% a year, brought the world out of the 2007-2008 economic crisis. According to Mirkin, it is this growth that enables the continued demand for the Russian raw materials, especially by China. In his opinion, the U.S. economic policy of quantitative easing, which involved the extensive intervention of the Federal Reserves into the economy, helped this positive scenario come about. In addition, Mirkin tries to define the features of the U.S. economic success, because he believes that Russia must learn from its competitors. First, he says, the U.S. promotes and rewards innovation talent, and expertise. Secondly, the United States behaves egotistically and does everything to further its own benefits. It does not copy anybody, but resolutely forges ahead. Lastly, the U.S. government minimally regulates the dealings of business. Mirkin thinks that Russia must do all these things if it is to compete successfully with the United States on the global economic arena. Mirkin also wants to dispel what he considers a myth of the U.S. bankruptcy. He states that the current U.S. debt, which, according to the International Monetary Fund, is 105% of the GDP, is not all that big for the country of the U.S. size and importance. Japan's debt, for instance, is 238% of the GDP. Also, the United States debt is in its own currency, the dollar, which it can print without asking any other country for permission. Moreover, most of the United States debt is held by domestic investors, which means that the debt is essentially the matter of the U.S. domestic policy.
Yep. Okay, bye. I found East Bay Times. This is where the po-po have to come to find out about their co-workers. Well, Sergeant Mike Gant filed a claim last month. Is there a date? Against the city of Oakland, according to high-ranking office officials, retaliation for his investigation into a fellow officer, Brendan O'Brien. He's shown here at press conference. It was the early morning hours of June 17, 2014. Oakland Police Department homicide investigators Mike Gant and Cesar Bassa sat across the table from rookie officer Brendan O'Brien in an interview room known as The Box, located deep inside OPD's downtown headquarters. This is where detectives interrogate murder suspects. Hours earlier, O'Brien had called OPD... That sounds like where I went to get the video back when they shot my friend in the back. And it was in the evidence, in the narcotics evidence. And yet, the cop who had shot during Operation Dead End at the Dead Show, there was Craig Chu. And so I got, arrested, and they seized the videotape out of the camera, but his not-so-cooperating officers put one of two on the tape because they gave me my camera back without the tape, where his partner is saying no rosebud is worth a good trained police dog. Well, I had to get that tape from the narcotics division because, of course, they're going around sticking their heads in the doorways saying, got any drugs? And these are uniformed officers, with their black trench coats and the baton hanging out from under it, and a dozen of these plainclothes goons. Never mind. I know this place they're talking about, The Box. Yeah. Anyway, hours earlier, O'Brien had called OPD's emergency dispatch number to report that his wife, Irma Huerta Lopez, shot herself in the head at his Oakland Hills apartment, but several details pertaining to the alleged suicide bothered Gant. G-A-N-T-T. He was suspicious about the gun and ammunition forensics at the crime scene, and he thought O'Brien's alibi didn't add up. Gant also said Bassa was pitching O'Brien softball questions. When it was his turn to interrogate, he zeroed in on inconsistencies in O'Brien's story. Gant intended to press the rookie just as he would any suspect. However, while questioning O'Brien about the holes in the young officer's account, Gant says he felt a sharp jolt to his legs. Bassa was kicking me under the table, he explained in a recent interview. The two investigators stepped out of the box. Bassa told me, he's a cop, you need to ease up, Gant recalled. Bassa, I think the guy killed his wife, he replied. Gant would never get to ask O'Brien any more questions. According to the veteran investigator, the lieutenant overseeing OPD's homicide unit at the time, John Lois, yanked him from the interrogation and eventually took him off the case. O'Brien was subsequently cleared as a suspect, and Huerta Lopez's death was classified as a suicide. The fact that an Oakland cop was the prime suspect in a murder investigation never hit the news. Eventually, O'Brien returned to work as a patrol officer. 8 months later, on the streets of East Oakland, he would meet and exploit a 17-year-old girl who went by the name Celeste Guap, the victim at the center of the OPD sex crime scandal. News of the Guap case made national headlines earlier this summer, but there has been little, if any, discussion of Huerta Lopez. That is until last week when Gant broke what he referred to as the OPD's blue wall of silence. This one time, he and I got in an argument, and he got angry, and he said, "I'll kill you too," unquote. Oh, I can tweet that right there. Click to tweet. How could we? Gant is currently on administrative leave, but says he is speaking out now because Oakland's police chief, mayor, and city administrator all retaliated against him. At first because he tried to investigate O'Brien, and later to distract the public from the scandalous exploitation of Guap by dozens of East Bay cops. Now, his shocking accusations call into question the official story of Huerta Lopez's death, but he's not alone in doubting the conclusions reached by OPD and the Alameda County District Attorney. Huerta Lopez's family also believed from the start O'Brien was the killer. They say that OPD ignored their concerns and didn't sufficiently follow through on the case. And even Guap, who says she was, quote, dating, unquote, O'Brien before he committed suicide last year, told Express that she thinks O'Brien was capable of shooting his wife and that he once threatened to kill her, too. Gant, who filed a claim of retaliation against the city of Oakland last week, stands by his intuition even 2 years later. "I believe he killed her," unquote. A suspicious death. Officer Brendan O'Brien called OPD's non-911 emergency number at 9:52 p.m. on the night of his wife's death, according to police dispatch records. Oakland officers Brendan Perry and Brandon Tyler were the first on scene. Perry said they encountered O'Brien, who they recognized as a fellow cop, standing in the front doorway of his apartment. He was wearing a gray T-shirt, gray basketball shorts, and no shoes or socks, he wrote in a report. Perry added that O'Brien had a distant stare in his eyes. O'Brien told them about an argument he had with his wife earlier that evening and her suspicions that he was having an affair. Perry and Taylor wrote in their report that O'Brien stated that he left the apartment and went to a gas station on Mountain Boulevard and 98th Avenue to buy cigarettes. He claimed that when he returned, he found his wife dead from a gunshot wound. Neither officer recorded whether O'Brien drove or walked to the station. In fact, none of the incident reports released by OPD make it clear how O'Brien traveled to the store, but an evidence technician who put her hand on the hood and grill of O'Brien's car 2 hours after he claimed to have bought the cigarettes wrote that it did not feel any warmer to me than the temperature inside the garage. There were several hints at the apartment that the marriage was near its end. Perry observed a female's wedding ring atop a paper towel on the coffee table in the living room. Police evidence technician Julie J-A-E-C-K-S-C-H, Jackish, later noticed a small plain band ring similar to the man's wedding band on the dresser in the bedroom. When police searched Huerta Lopez's car that was parked across the street, they found a large quantity of clothing in the trunk. On the dining room, they saw O'Brien and Huerta Lopez's marriage certificate placed next to a neat pile of papers. Next to that was an envelope marked "Do not open." Under the direction of Lieutenant Roland Holmgren and Sergeant Sylvia Rodriguez, who were supervising the scene, other officers took statements from residents in the building, other three units. One of O'Brien's neighbors signed a written statement that at about 10 p.m. they were inside their apartment when they heard a noise that sounded like thump. It wasn't loud, but it wasn't faint. They opened the door, their balcony door, which faces the building's only driveway and the lone staircase leading to the entrance, and stepped out into the night. They didn't see or hear anything, including gunfire, and they didn't report hearing or seeing O'Brien return home, either on foot or by car. Full text. There's more. This one, oh, and he said he'd kill you too. O'Brien is tailbone to buy a pack of cigarettes, got to recall, but he wasn't a smoker. Another key to P evidence that experts say cast out on O'Brien's story is the gunshot residue test results. Both O'Brien and Huerta Lopez's hands were swabbed, and the tests, which were completed 4 days later, showed that they both had recently fired a gun. OPD officials claim that O'Brien had residue on his hands because, as an officer, he frequently handles and shoots firearms. It's not clear, though, when O'Brien last fired his weapon in the line of duty or during a firearms training. It's also unclear whether investigators ever asked O'Brien if he had recently gone to a gun range practice. For Huerta Lopez to have gunshot residue on her hands, she either would have had to fire a gun or touch a gun that had been recently fired. But O'Brien also could have rubbed his hands on hers after he shot a gun. OPD did not conduct a gunshot residue test on clothing worn by O'Brien and Huerta Lopez or other clothing in the house that O'Brien might have been wearing earlier that night. Another unusual feature of the O'Brien apartment was the ammunition, both loose and also loaded into magazines. The investigators found scattered about several rooms. They found a box of .40 caliber handgun ammunition on the dresser in the bedroom. In the closet, they came across additional live ammo for a .45 caliber handgun. They located two Glock pistol magazines under the coffee table in the living room and in the pockets of a pair of black technical pants on the living room floor. They recovered another 25 rounds of handgun ammo. Later, when they searched O'Brien Mazda, which was parked below his apartment in one of the building's four garages, they found 40 caliber Glock model 23 handgun with loaded magazine and live round in the chamber. Under the driver's seat, they also found live loose handgun round, as well as several blank rounds. O'Brien, ex-Marine, was no stranger to guns. He told fellow officers the pistol that killed Huerta Lopez was personally registered to him, as was the gun they found in his car. But it's unclear whether anyone asked O'Brien why so much ammunition was found lying around his house. The alibi. One key to determining if Huerta Lopez's death was murder or suicide would be verifying O'Brien's story. That's why at 11:23 p.m. on the night of her death, patrol officer Jerem Stein and Danny Cheng drove to the Shell gas station near his apartment, where O'Brien claimed to have bought a pack of cigarettes. With the help of the store clerk, they reviewed the station video surveillance footage from 8:30 p.m. to 10 p.m. They should have seen O'Brien arrive by cigarettes and leave, but O'Brien didn't appear anywhere in the tape, according to police report. However, investigators say they found a receipt for a pack of cigarettes from the gas station with a timestamp of 9:45 p.m. inside O'Brien's car. 2 days later, this discrepancy was solved. Bassa had another sergeant, Inez Ramirez, visit the Shell station and review the video again. Ramirez reported that its timestamp was approximately 1 hour and 2 minutes delayed. She burned the new footage on a DVD and turned it into OPD evidence unit. Ramirez was also copied surveillance camera footage taken by a homeowner who lives on Keller Avenue near O'Brien's apartment. Despite multiple requests, OPD hasn't released the Shell station surveillance footage to the Express. In addition, the department has body camera footage taken by officers Stein and Cheng from the night they reviewed the footage, but this also hasn't been released. According to Huerta Lopez's family, police told them the footage confirmed O'Brien's story. They said OPD officers even showed them parts of the video of O'Brien at the gas station. The owner of the Shell station, Shah Mohammed, told the Express in a recent interview that he used the same DVR surveillance system for about 8 years. He said it usually records up to 3 days of material before purging footage. According to Mohammed, multiple cameras captured video of the parking lot, gas pumps, and inside the store. He said it's possible the system timestamp wasn't updated when daylight savings changed. But Gantz said last week that he never bought O'Brien's gas station alibi. O'Brien claimed he and his wife had an argument because she suspected he was having an affair. As Gantz remembers it, O'Brien said he left the apartment and walked barefoot almost 2 miles away to Shell Station. When he returned, O'Brien said he found his wife on their blood-soaked bed with a bullet wound to her head. O'Brien told us he walked 10 blocks barefoot to buy a pack of cigarettes, Gantt recalled during a recent interview. But he wasn't a smoker, Gantt added. And to walk or even sprint 1.8 miles back from the gas station at 9:45 at night and arrive at his apartment at 9:52 when he called the police would have been impossible. So he had to have driven. Yet, according to Gantt, his original story was that he walked. It's also difficult to verify O'Brien's alibi because OPD and the coroner never established an exact time of death for Huerta Lopez. It's also forensically impossible to know exactly what time she died. What is known is that OPD claims to possess surveillance footage showing O'Brien at the Shell station before or around 9:45 p.m., which the receipt in his car seems to confirm. OPD dispatch records show that he called the department's emergency line at 9:52, presumably from his apartment, and one of his neighbors saw him there shortly after he made that call. But none of this establishes an airtight alibi. To speculate, O'Brien could have shot Huerta Lopez before he walked or drove to the station, or she could have even been shot after. It only takes 3 minutes to drive from the gas station to the apartment. O'Brien might have left his wife in the apartment, drove to the stove, purchased cigarettes at 9:45 p.m., gone back up the hill to his apartment, immediately shot Huerta Lopez in the bedroom, then called to report her death by 9:52 p.m. The cigarette explanation is odd in another respect. Again, O'Brien reportedly wasn't a smoker, yet he went to buy a pack, and despite the stress of the situation, he didn't immediately smoke one. Instead, according to police records, he went back to his apartment and discovered his wife. He called the cops and waited for them to arrive, but even then he didn't light up. According to police technician Astra Goddard, who arrived after multiple OPD officers and firefighters were already on scene, there was an unopened package of cigarettes on the round table in the living room north of the front door. She later noticed the package had been moved, and other officers saw O'Brien eventually smoking the cigarettes just outside of the back door of his apartment, covering for him. Back at OPD headquarters, after Gant and Bass's argument outside the box, the two investigators took a short break from interrogating O'Brien. Gant went to the bathroom, and Bassa, according to Gant, went into the office of Lieutenant John Lois. "When I came out of the bathroom, Lois called me into his office and told me to shut the door," Gant recalled. He claims that Lois immediately took him off the case. "Give Bassa your notes," Gant says, Lois told him. The lieutenant allegedly offered no further explanation. O'Brien was subsequently cleared of any official suspicion, and OPD and the sheriff coroner classified Huerta's Lopez's death as a suicide. Deputy District Attorney Matthew Beltramo and Inspector Tom Milner from the District Attorney's Office, who watched Bassa and Gant interview with O'Brien via a satellite office that night, didn't even take notes or file reports. It's unclear how long O'Brien was on leave, but he eventually went back to work as a patrol officer. He also continued to live in the same apartment, and local media never reported Huerta Lopez's death or OPD brief investigation of O'Brien, but that wasn't the end of it. A year later, a bomb went off that would engulf the entire OPD. O'Brien shot himself in the head on September 25th, 2015, in the same apartment where Huerta Lopez died. The officer had been struggling with alcoholism, depression, insomnia. He left a two-page typewritten suicide note that, according to department sources, contained shocking information. In it, O'Brien addressed and denied the allegations that he and several other Oakland cops were sexually exploiting a Richmond teenager, Celeste Guap, when she was a sexually trafficked child on the streets of East Oakland. Guap is now 19-year-old, but the Express is not using her real name because she was a minor when she was abused and because she has not personally consented to being identified. Last week, at a press conference, Gant said that he feels O'Brien was never suitably interviewed because he was one of the OPD's own. When asked why the department mishandled and buried the case, he said, "Simply bad press." In fact, Huerta Lopez's death came at a time when OPD and other Oakland officials were pushing hard to end 13 years of oversight by a court-appointed monitor and federal judge. Officials, including then Police Chief Sean Wendt, W-H-E-N-T, were hopeful that the court would, S-E-A-N, because there's so many Seans, S-E-A-N, W-H-E-N-T, would declare OPD's problems all stemming from previous corruption and misconduct scandal in the early 2000s, kicking to death Jerry O'Morrow by the head of internal affairs, you know, having two duplicate, one for internal, but they're contradictory. One says, okay, the public thing says the copies were sent to internal affairs, But the internal says the case was sent to internal. You appreciate that thing that's going on since 2000. Under federal court thing, so this whole time, the head of internal affairs, Paulson, is it or something, would have been locked up if he wasn't head of internal affairs. And this would return full control of OPD back to the chief and city administrator, but O'Brien's suicide note forced the department to open an internal affairs investigation into the Guap case, and this investigation, according to U.S. Judge, District Judge Selton Henderson, was botched. Sources close to the department told Express that Guap's exploitation at the hands of multiple cops, including O'Brien, was a matter that top police brass wanted to bury because it could imperil their chances of getting out from under federal court oversight. During the past several months, multiple former homicide investigators from Bay Area agencies have spoken with the Express about the apparent gaps and shortcomings in the Huerta Lopez case. They also questioned the homicide division's leadership and LOIS, Lois's role in both the Huerta Lopez case and investigating the Guap sex crime scandal. Lois, whose rapid rise from lieutenant to deputy chief in less than a year is unprecedented in OPD, was in charge during the O'Brien investigation. Prior to his arrival in the unit, Lois had never investigated a murder. Instead, he spent the bulk of his career in the Internal Affairs Division, where he established a close relationship with Wendt, whose wife told him about the whole biz, okay, right before he resigned. But anyway, past homicide investigators told the Express, oh yeah, so his wife was curious and just went on Facebook, you know, and stuff. In social media, so past homicide investigators told the Express that Lois's leadership resulted in bad police work. They specifically criticized Lois' alleged decision to take Grant off the O'Brien case, to not order a test of O'Brien's clothing for gunshot residue, and to not call O'Brien in for a second interview. Gant's account of Gant's account of his removal from Huerta Lopez's investigation is difficult to verify. Both Lois, who is now a deputy chief, and Bassa, B-A-S-A, who now works for Alameda County DA as an inspector, did not respond to requests to discuss the Huerta Lopez case or Gant's accusations. OPD and Mayor Libby Schaaf released only a three-sentence statement which said that they are legally prohibited from discussing Gant's claims because they involve personnel matters. Furthermore, both OPD and the district attorney have refused to release the bulk of the records. I wonder why. In the Huerta Lopez case file, despite multiple requests from the... I'll tell you why. It's because it will put the mayor on down to jail. Because, yeah. On misprison of felony, if nothing else. And other Armenian organizations. But Gant wasn't the only person who thinks O'Brien killed his wife. Huerta Lopez's family member... Oh, I already read this. That it was a homicide and that police covered for the rookie officer. Two of her relatives declined requests to be interviewed for this story. But Huerta Lopez's sister told Express in a previous interview that Irma and O'Brien met online, briefly dated, and then got married. Their relationship was rocky. The two occasionally fought, but not physically. Pauline also said O'Brien was always weird and that she was worried about her sister when she married him. They were all covering for him, was how she described the way Oakland police treated her family after her sister died. Police records and coroner's report all note that Huerta's family was suspicious of O'Brien and contacted OPD multiple times for updates on the case. At one point, Bassa even encouraged the family to maintain contact with O'Brien on the belief that he might disclose something of evidence value, unquote, according to the district attorney's review. Guap also think O'Brien was capable of murder. She met him in February 15 while he was patrolling East Oakland. He, quote, saved, unquote, her from a pimp, she says, and claims they later met up on multiple occasions that she had, quote, dated him, unquote. This one time, he and I got into an argument and he got angry, Guap told Express in a recent interview about an interaction with O'Brien mid-2015, and he said, I'll kill you too. Guap said she believes he was capable of violence. She wasn't aware at the time, though, that O'Brien was once suspected by his own department of killing his wife. She only knew that O'Brien was formerly married and that his spouse died from what O'Brien told her was a, quote, sickness, unquote. Gant, 27-year-old PD veteran, Bronx native, has a decorated but also contentious history within the department. He has won National Association of Police Organizations Top Cop Award, 4 OPD Medals of Merit, and a Captain's Certificate of Commendation, among other honors. However, Gant says that about a month after he was removed from the Huerta Lopez investigation, several homicide inspectors improperly accessed and viewed his personnel records as part of an effort to harass and harm. Gant filed the complaint but claims the department took no action, so as a result, he transferred out of what he described as a hostile environment and it ended up in the patrol section. 6 months ago, he was suspended from his duties after a domestic dispute with his wife. An internal affairs case was opened because of the incident. Gant was also recently named by sources in the department as being the subject of an investigation concerning the alleged mishandling of evidence during his time in the homicide unit. Gant had a girlfriend transcribe audio interviews of a person suspected of the 2013 murder of Maxwell Park resident Judy Salamon, S-A-L-A-M-O-N. But the Alameda County DA declared him of any criminal misconduct in June. Last week, Gant said he was unaware of any department policy that forbids third-party transcriptions of interviews. OPD didn't respond to a request by the Express to provide copies of any department policies barring third-party transcriptions. He was also previously fired, so it sounds like they're going after him for whistleblowing. He was also previously fired by the department in 2004 for allegedly meddling in a rape case against a former friend from the military, but Gant won his job back in arbitration after his attorney Michael Raines, piss on Michael Raines, revealed that an unnamed deputy chief was playing favorites and inconsistently punishing others, including Gant. He says he decided to come forward about OPD's handling of the Huerta Lopez case as a result of alleged retaliation and harassment directed at him by senior officers in the police department and Oakland city officials, including city administrator Sabrina Landris and Schaaf, S-C-H-A-A-F. In a claim Grant filed against the city last week, his attorney Dan Siegel alleged that actions by city officials are part of a campaign by retaliation and stigmatization against him and that result from Gant's efforts to investigate officers O'Brien for the death of his wife and for filing complaints against other members of the homicide unit, unquote. He also accused the city leaking dirt about him to the media to deflect attention from allegations that multiple Oakland police officers had engaged in the sexual exploitation of young women. The thin blue line is alive and well, Gant said. If you step over that line, you're an outcast. I've stepped over that line. But Siegel says there's also something bigger at stake. Did OPD cover up an investigation of one of their own, as he put it during press conference last week? We may never know if O'Brien killed his wife. The truth died with him. Well, I don't think so. I think it is obvious as fucking hell.